Hey folks, this is Kevin. Just a few words before we start. You are about to hear the very first episode of Extra Risk. But before we get there, I just want to say that tomorrow night, that is July 8th at the UCB Theater in Los Angeles, we have a show. I was talking to the producer out there, Madison Perry. He thinks it's going to be the best show we've had in Los Angeles so far. We have Steve Agee of the Sarah Silverman Program, Melinda Hill of Important Things with Dimitri Martin. We have Brian Callen of The Hangover and Entourage, and we have Annabelle Gurwitch of Dexter and Seinfeld. A really remarkable group of people. And it's going to be hosted. We have a replacement host tomorrow night, the brilliant Moshe Kasher of Chelsea Lately and Jimmy Fallon's show. One more thing. If you are in New York, our next storytelling workshop that we teach through our school, the Story Studio, that you can find at thestorystudio.org. The next 9-week workshop starts next Tuesday, July 12th. So go to thestorystudio.org to sign up. And now here's the show.
Suddenly your mind exploded, suddenly your lungs inhaled, suddenly there you were, again.
Extra Risk.
Hello, kids. This is the very first episode of Extra Risk. A little bit more of the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. That was a mashup up top by Jeff Barr of a tune by Jordan Cooper and another tune by Robbie Seahag. And this is the marquees behind me now. Well, if you've never heard Risk at all, I highly recommend you check out one of our regular episodes. These Extra Risk episodes are going to come between the regular episodes. This is a place where we think we can start experimenting, trying new things. That's always been a priority of ours with the show. And so here, for example, we might just focus on one story or a conversation, or in the case of this particular episode, both one story and a conversation. I sat down last week with an old friend of mine, Tom Shalhoub. Tom and I go way back. My background is in sketch comedy. His is in stand-up, but Tom has always done more storytelling in his act than straight stand-up, and I've always been a huge admirer of his. Tom is a person who just loves people, and that really radiates through his stories. Tom has a more improvisational style of storytelling where he's really right there conversing with the audience, and you're not sure where it's going sometimes. He takes on a broad canvas for a story, and he did so with a story he told at Risk a couple months ago. So when I sat down with him last week, we talked about that story. I call that story The Tributaries of Canobie Park. So what you're about to hear for the next half hour or so is that story that he told at the Risk Live show, intercut with our conversation about the story. And so, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tom Shalhoub.
I was long fascinated by the lateral thinking format. My brother and I used to tease each other with these puzzles when I was a kid, where they would ask the question. They would say, a man walks into a bar, walks up to the bartender, asks for a glass of water. The bartender pulls out a gun and points it at the man. The man says thank you and leaves. What is happening? And then after like 2 days of questioning, you find out that the guy had the hiccups.
Yeah.
And he walked into the bar hiccuping. The man pulled out the gun, scaring him. Oh, fine. So I used to, you know, pull these on my friends all the time. When I was a waiter in New York, when I first got in the city, I was always standing in the wait station. And I would say, a man walks into a bar. They'd be like, shut the hell up with the stupid puzzles. So I always loved the lateral thinking format. Okay. Five men sit at bar stools at a lunch counter. Four are wearing straw hats. One is wearing a top hat. The man behind the lunch counter flips a coin
It lands tails. The four men with straw hats stand up. The man in the top hat runs out of the diner and flees the scene. Moments later, the man with the top hat is holding it in his lap and he's weeping. The men with the straw hats look on. What is happening? Yes or no questions? Yes or no questions? Go ahead. Yes or no questions about that situation?
Did he lose something?
Did he lose something? Yes, he did. Good question. Keep them coming. Did the men know each other? Yes, they did. Good question.
Was he black?
He was not black. Weird and good question. Was this the 70s? It was not the 70s.
Good.
It was not in the South. Good question.
What was in his hand?
What was in his hand? A top hat, as I said.
Excellent.
There was something in his top hat. Good question. What's that? It was not a dead rabbit. Getting warmer. Excellent. Don't you love the lateral thinking puzzle format? Sometimes I reflect and I think that the stories from my own life follow that format. We have almost solved it, so I'll help you and I'll solve it now. It takes a little backstory.
One night when I was trying to come up with a story to tell, the story of Canobie Lake Park, I was trying to tell it, but it's weird to get it. Sometimes to get into a story, there's a lot of unfascinating information you have to get through to get to the meat of your story.
Yeah.
And so storytellers, we're always trying to pare down that setup, you know what I mean? And yeah. It's like, get to the point. You probably do this when you work with storytellers. You're like, you know what? You think all that information is necessary, but it's not. So pare it down.
Yeah.
And so we're always trying to crush it down. But for this particular story, I needed a lot of information at the top. And so I was trying to think of how to say it, and I thought, well, wait a minute, why don't I just go to the end? And I said, but then I'm going to ruin the surprise. So I said, oh, that's it. It's a puzzle. So I said, why don't I tell the ending of the story as a mystery without explaining it, and then you get people interested, and then go back to the beginning and start over again. So I thought, that's like the lateral thinking puzzles that I used to tell as a kid. So I took a lot of my stories and I started setting them up as lateral thinkers, you know?
In the late 80s, my barbershop quartet, I've long sung barbershop, I don't know if that surprises anyone, we were hired to sing in Canobie Lake Park, 6 shows a day in Salem, New Hampshire, right down by the riverboat. It was fantastic. It was a dream come true. I had just finished my first year of college, and now I was in show business. I was making $210 a week. Fantastic. And I was with these other show business people. It was my first exposure to New York show people.
Where is this place, Canobie Park?
Canobie Lake Park, Salem, New Hampshire. It is on Canobie Lake.
Yeah.
A great idyllic spot. Amazing. It's an amusement park right on the water. And it's a destination for all these New Englanders.
And you were about, what, 21, 22?
I must have been, well, it was my first year of college, but I took a year off after high school. And then, so it was not even, you know, maybe about 20.
And what's the appeal of barbershop? You know, like, my ex-husband was way into barbershop. And the first thing was, I assumed that everyone would be gay.
Yeah.
Just because it's singing, you associate that with, like, glee clubs or whatever. But no one was. Oh, yeah. My husband was
He was in the society, the barbershop society?
Or? Yeah, he was in one of these big New York barbershop groups.
Yeah, yeah, it's really straight. It's actually like, it was more, you know, it started in the 30s.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was old-time music back then.
Uh-huh.
But a guy started in Oklahoma, and it was like businessmen who loved old-time music, and they would get together. So it was more founded in a kind of a Rotary Club way.
Oh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And it was more about like men getting together and sharing a beer and singing a song. You know, it was like very it was kind of an old American men's group, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so when I joined the society in the late 80s, we were singing barbershop in the high school show, and a guy from the barbershop society, which was, it seemed like this secret society.
Was it the music man?
No, we were just doing a barbershop number in the high school show. Because we would hang around after school, and the music teacher was trying to keep us out of trouble, so he would give us these charts to sing. And then somebody said, oh, you got to do that in the show. So we did a number in the show. And then this guy dragged us down to the local meeting, and it was in the basement of a church. And all these guys were like, hey, you young kids are the greatest. You know, because we were so young to them. We were 17, and it was mostly these old World War II vets and Korean War vets and guys like that. And to see these guys singing. You know, it was great. These old barbershoppers. So we joined the society, and it was a blast. You know, it was like, it was kind of part of the fun of it was not just the singing, but being around all these old guys. You know,
yeah,
like these kind of old guys who are like butchers and, you know, doctors and lawyers, whatever. All this different mix of you know, socioeconomic status and all this, like they all came together just to sing. And so we loved it. And then we got the job at Canterbury Lake Park. You know, we went and auditioned with all the show people, you know, like they, how people go down to Disney and Busch Gardens and these places, you know? Uh-huh. So we walked in, and I think usually they put these quartets together with show people, you know, but we walked in ready to sing with a whole repertoire of songs. So we got hired. And so then it was us from kind of that world, you know,
and
these kind of like suburban
boys.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Four of us from Norwood, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And we went up there, and so we were the only non-show people there. Everyone else had come out of like summer stock in that world. And then so we were deposited in this amusement park as a musical unit, but then we were surrounded by all the theater people, you know? So I had never seen like real show people up until that point.
Wow.
So it was really like, you know, we all lived together in a motel, and it was real show business, you know?
I had never seen the real New York gay guys up close. I'd never seen any gay guys. This was the late 80s. There were no gays in the suburbs. They didn't make it out there. There was no gays in high schools back then. I don't know. Some people, you're too young to remember. In the 80s, no gay in high school. Now there's gay high schools, whole high schools of gay. There is a gay high school in New York. There was no such thing then. No gays in high school. Each school had a handful of extremely sad students. That's how it worked out. But they were New York gay guys, and we weren't homophobic, but we kind of kept to ourselves. We were the barbershop quartet and the magician. You know, what's straighter than a magician, right? So it was always us. We thought we were so macho. We're like, yeah, barbershop, you know? And always the gay guys were always off in the other rooms in the Pine Valley Motel in Hooksett, New Hampshire. And they were doing their own parties. You know, we had our party. We would sing barbershop tags, and Tab Halley, the magician, would do close-up magic. And I loved close-up. He was amazing. He would always do his close-up magic. And then we'd say, how did you do that? And he wouldn't even reveal it to us. Another showbiz chum, he kept the magician's secret. He would do amazing close-up magic, and I'd say, Tab, tell me, how did you do that? And he said, don't trust your eyes, don't trust your ears, trust your heart. He would say, don't trust your eyes, don't trust your ears, trust your heart. And he always did that magician kind of thing with his hand. Even when he was hanging out drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon, it was always, don't trust your eyes. And Tab kept this is a real straight guy thing, he kept his magician uniform on all day. Like, we would come home from the park, and he stayed in his spandex pants, the ones that, like, went up to here. He had, like, a tuxedo with the shirt tucked into the spandex, and you could kind of see the shirt tails. And then it would go down, and you could see his, like, underwear line. And he always had, like, a bulge. Like, they were tight pants, and he always had this bulge on one side. And he'd be sitting there drinking beer with us, doing close-up magic. And, like, he always, I mean, not that I was focused on the package, but it was always on one side. I remember that. It never moved. Like, I always thought, like, he was always in those pants. Like, if you ever moved the package over, it seems like there would be, like, a little memory bulge there in the spandex.
Three separate worlds. The barbershop quartet was kind of independent contractors on their own. We roamed the park singing barbershop. And then you had the magician. He had his own magic hut right in the middle of the park. And then you had the show people who had two shows. The Salute to America and Broadway, which was all full of patriotic Broadway songs. And then you had the Country Hoedown, where they would change clothes from their patriotic vests and whatnot. They would get into the country hoedown hats, you know, the straw hats and Lil Abner overalls, and they would do a kind of an Americana hoedown in the hay or something like that. And right. Then they would quickly change, run back, and be, you know, patriotic. So they had two shows to do.
Right.
The guy who ran it, I'll never forget, his name was Dave Gerton. The place was called Showbiz Incorporated, the people who hired. And it was Showbiz Incorporated. Dave Gerton was the man, Mr. G, they called him. And he would come in, and he had silk scarves. He had, like, you know, big hair. He kind of looked like one of the, you know, Siegfried or Roy. Who was the blonde one? He looked like the blonde Siegfried or Roy, one of those two. And he would wear, you know, flamboyant suits and scarves, and he drove a Jaguar that said Mr. G on it, you know. And he would pull up, and then, Mr. G is coming. And then all the dancers would get in a line, and he would say, all right, run the Salute to Broadway. And then they would have to run it for him. He's like, pick up the bass. And you know, he was screaming. It was like classic old showbiz, you know. Mr. G, Showbiz Incorporated. But the people would come out of there. These kids were better. I've been to Broadway, and you guys were better. You know what I mean? They loved it. They loved it. In this American Idol world we live in now, you have stardom. It's always about like starting and stardom, making it to the top, you know. And then you have the Hollywood press, you know, and they talk about these stars, you know, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, all this kind of stuff. But really, show business in this country, it really lives in these little places, you know. That's where, you know, when they talk about only, you know, what is it? There's only 2% of actors working at any given time, you know. It is mostly a non-professional pursuit. And then you have this pocket, which is the world of professional show business. They're not stars. They're not, you know, making it big. But all over the country, you have actors working in you know, dinner theater and amusement parks. And in New York, I mean, we see the world of improv and everything. Everybody's working for free or for peanuts. And that's where show business is. No one really pays attention to that, but that's the majority of show that happens in this country is these little weird shows that we kind of all make fun of, you know? Yeah. But that's my tradition. You know, when I die, say if I have great success, still 90% of my show business life is going to be playing these tiny rooms.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, we're in the People's Improv Theater right now, and I often think of some of these people I know, like Zach Galifianakis or Ellie Kemper, who end up in these big Hollywood movies,
yeah.
And all I can think of is how much more fun and wonderful and magical it was the night they did something in some little room here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You go to see these big movies that everyone knows, and it just feels so far away.
Yeah, and there's still, you know, when I go out to Bobby Tisdale's show in Greenpoint, Zach's sitting there watching the show.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He wants to watch a comedy show, you know.
Right.
So you know that's where he has fun, you know, at Bobby Tisdale's show.
Right.
But it was the three worlds, the three different cultures. You had the show people, then you had the barbershop quartet, and then Tab Halley, the magician. So, you know, I think that's why we ended up hanging out with Tab, because he was more like the barbershop guys, you know, like magicians. They have their own, they come from their own weird world, you know.
Also very straight, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like a very, why is it? Why is magic? So the thing is, it's not really, like when you see a big magic show,
yeah,
it is like, it is full of very gay pageantry, you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
So you would think that there would be this kind of like, you would think that magic would be the purview of the gay world, but really, it's super straight. You ever go to a magic convention? It's like a Star Trek convention or a barbershop convention. Very straight.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Tab was a guy who was, you know, he was probably 10 years older than us, I guess. 10 or 15 years older, whatever it was. But, you know, he seemed so much older. When you're 20, if there's a guy in his 30s, he just seems like an old guy, you know. So he was a magician who had been making a living for years. But he was playing Canopy Lake Park, you know. Not the greatest. It wasn't like he was at Busch Gardens or, you know. This is not where he wanted to be. So he wasn't happy. And he would drink beer with these quartet guys, and he would do close-up magic for us. You know, he still loved performing for people, but he was a little bit, maybe the kind of bitter magician, because he wasn't playing Vegas. He wasn't playing the big rooms, you know. He was in Canopy Lake, like a C-level entertainment gig. And so he was a little bit sleepy, you know. He's a little bit sleepy on stage, running through his act. We used to make fun of him because we'd be like, "All right, this next act of Peerless Prestidigitation." Like he had this kind of like this kind of Dean Martin quality to his voice. For my next bit of Prestidigitation, you know, and we see Tab's heart is not in it, you know. And he had the spandex pants that he'd wear every day. You know, he was kind of he was a little too heavy to be wearing spandex, but he stuck with it because that's the, you know, that's the suit that got him his first job, probably. And he would drive around in a sports car, you know. But he was a lonely guy. He was a loner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he used to hit on his magician's assistant. She didn't like that very much, you know. She would confide in us that Tab was driving her crazy. But to us, he was, you know, he was skilled. He was a pro. He'd been working in the business for years as a professional. To us, that was like, you know, it was amazing. This guy's been making his living as a magician. And he was great at magic, so we looked up to the guy, you know? Whereas now we might look at him and think, oh, it's sad to have Hadley work, you know, a guy in his 30s working in an amusement park. But, you know, to a 20-year-old, this guy was making it.
But the gay guys would be over there and partying. They were always so dramatic. I was kind of interested. I mean, I was not interested in, like, the gay guys, but I was interested in their lifestyle. They were dramatic. They did everything in a dramatic way. And one night it was raining outside, raining cats and dogs, and I opened the door because I heard a door slam, and I thought someone's breaking up or something. They were always like, there would be breakups and drama and whatnot. And I opened the door, and there was Tony. He was walking through the rain, you know, dramatically. He led with his hips like Bob Fosse style, and he was walking through the rain. And I saw him, and I could see it was Tony. I was like, who's there? And even though I could see him, I was caught in his drama. I was like, who's there? And he walked through the rain, but he didn't even stop. He stopped under the light. He always found his light, you know, under the lamppost. And the rain was coming down over his head, washing him down, soaking that long hair of his. And he heard, who's there? And he went, frrr. He flicked his head. He was like that. And the raindrops came shooting off his hair, like, frrr. And he said, a faggot in the rain. What's it to you? I closed the door, and my barbershop buddies were like, what was that? And I said, I can't even tell you what I just saw. I swear to God, I've lived in New York 20 years. That's still the gayest thing I've ever seen.
Inside circles of outsiders.
Yeah. Well, of course, they all, that's the funny thing is that you are, you're up there, and, you know, you're this, you know, kid from the suburbs, you know, and then you see these show people, and all the guys are these like New York gay theater guys, right? It was like all the guys were, and then all the girls were like, you know, the New York theater girls. But it was like, it seemed like the gay community, like writ large, you know. But I was talking to John Flynn about his experience in the theater world, and he, you know, he was hired by a park, and he was like coming out just then, you know what I mean? Like that was his, you know, he was there, just, and it was his first exposure to the kind of gay world and everything like that. So from my perspective, these were all these kind of like New York, like these kind of like experienced gay guys, you know, but I bet a lot of them were just, it was their first summer away,
right,
you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And they've got their own stories, you know what I mean? Like they were probably as naive as I was,
yeah.
You know? But it was, you know, it may have been a summer of discovery for them, you know, well.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, they're just like, you know, they had it going on. They were like 20 years old and they, you know, came out of the New York theater world and everything, you know, but I'm sure it was a bunch of kids from Omaha and Nebraska, you know, and Illinois and everything like that.
Yeah.
But we stuck to ourselves and I would sit and watch Close Up Magic. And it wasn't the whole quartet. It was just three of us. And our bass, Jim, lived next door. He and his Christian roommate, Brad, he brought Brad up to Canopy Lake Park to kind of be his Christian buddy, his little, you know, his little watchtower, because they both prayed together and they read the Bible. They literally did Bible study while we were drinking Pabst Blue Ribbon, and the gay guys were getting all crazy over there. And in between the gay guys and us was that Christian room, and they would just read the Bible, and then they would go to sleep in their bunk beds. And Brad worked at the park as a Ferris wheel guy. He was actually a carny for the summer, a Christian carny. And so the two of them would study Bibles, and we would sing Barbershop and drink Pabst Blue Ribbon, and we would talk about Tab's assistant, Judy the magician's assistant, in her little one piece, and she had a nice rump, and we would just talk about her and drink Pabst Blue Ribbon, you know, nothing untoward, we would just speak about her and lust after her. And Tab would lust after her as well, but nobody could touch Judy. She was untouchable, but we talked about her. That's as far as it went. There was no sex going on. I was still a virgin at the time, of course. But we would sing Barbershop. You know, we'd be singing about Sweet Sue down by the river and sinking and drinking beer and talking about Judy. It was dirty. And then we would go off to the park.
Judy, the magician's assistant, was the one we lusted after, okay? All us straight guys, we were all lusting after Judy. And see, the gay guys were having all the sex they wanted. They were having great times and relationships and whatnot. So we thought we were all going to get lucky because it was all these straight girls and there was only four available straight guys, the three non-born-again Christians in the quartet, and then Tab Halley, the magician. Okay? And we knew the girls didn't like Tab, you know? So we thought, they're going to go for these barbershop guys. So I would lust after Judy, the magician's assistant. And then there was another girl named Nicole. And she was the sweetest girl. She used to do yoga outside my hotel room. And I would look out in the morning and I would see her out there doing yoga in the tall grass. I'd say, oh, Nicole, you know, We were all just like, you know, we were, it was a dry summer for us. Several years later, I opened up the newspaper. Airplane goes down over Lockerbie, Scotland. And it had those big headshots in the paper of all the students that were on the airline, many from Syracuse University. One of them, Nicole, the girl from Syracuse, the girl who used to do yoga outside my window, she had left the amusement park early to go to Syracuse University. And then she took her next year abroad, and she was flying back on her trip, her year abroad. She was flying back, and she was in the airplane over Lockerbie, Scotland. I saw her headshot sitting there in the paper. I was like, that was Nicole, the lovely girl who used to do yoga outside my window.
Okay, so as to the man crying into his hat, one morning we were at Ralph's Diner, and Ralph, we would go there every morning for breakfast, the quartet and Tab Halley. And Ralph had this little thing where he would flip a coin and he would say, I'll flip you for breakfast. And it would be double or nothing. We would get free breakfast if we won. And if he won the coin toss, we would have to pay for our breakfast and sing a song for him. So he flipped the coin. He said, flip you for breakfast, like he did every day. Bing! He flipped it up. I said, heads, boom, it landed tails. You got to pay for breakfast and start singing. So we stood up to sing. We started singing, you know, who's in the strawberry patch with Sally? You know, we're singing. And inexplicably, Tab Halley gets up from his bar stool and runs out of the diner. He gets into his IROC and he drives off. And we were like, what the hell happened to Tab? We kept up the song, you know, like, bum, 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 bum. And we saw him speed away. So why would Tab leave so quickly? And we had to pay his breakfast. And so we finished up our song, we paid for the breakfast, and we left. We got to the park, and there was Tab, sitting there. Tab finished every show with a big flourish. He would take his birds, he would be doing close-up magic and card tricks, and then he would open up his coat, and birds would fly out. Doves would fly out all around his stage, and then he would pull off his top hat, and they would fly one by one into his top hat, and he would fold up the top hat, and he would throw it off stage. And he would say, trust not your eyes, not your ears, trust your heart. That was his flourish at the end of the show. So here he was sitting looking into his hat, and he was weeping. Now, I learned not only what had happened, but I learned how magicians do that trick with the doves. Do you know how they do that? The dove trick? It's not a trick. They just shove the doves into a hat. They shove them in, they crush it up, and doves are just, they crush. They don't make a sound. When they crush, they just calm down. Brr, 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 brr. That's one of the qualities of a white dove. They keep their mouth shut when crushed into a small space. That's all of magic. Anytime you've ever seen that trick, that's all it is. Shoving them into a small space. But you have to let the birds out after the trick is over. After the show, he would open his hat, put his birds back in his cage. Tab had forgotten to take the birds out of the hat. At breakfast, while we were singing Who's in the Strawberry Patch with Sally, maybe somebody mentioned a swallow or something, and he remembered. He got up from his bar stool, and he ran to save his birds. They had already died. He was looking at a hat full of dead birds. Yes, it's sad. But we did learn the trick. That's the positive part. Okay. So in preparation for tonight's show, I thought I'd do a little research, and I thought, I wonder if Tab Halley is still doing magic. I looked him up on the internet, and I found one webpage that referenced Tab Halley. In Memoriam. Tab Halley in Memoriam from his high school. I quickly did some more Google searches, and I found another magician who had referenced Tab Halley in his blog. And he said, oh, things haven't hit the fan like that since the Tab Halley funeral. And I said, he knew the late Tab Halley. So I wrote him an email. I said, sir, I worked with Tab at Canobie Lake Park. Could you tell me what happened to him? He sent me back an email. It was like 8 pages long. It was fully detailed, and I will read it for you right now. I said, could you tell me about Tab Halley? And then I closed it, the email, by saying, hey, by the way, I asked him about the late Tab Halley. And then I thought I'd throw a compliment his way. I didn't really look at his magic website, but I said, BTW, nice website. You know, I figured I would just pay him a compliment. So he starts off, thanks, man. Funnily enough, I haven't updated my site in at least 2 years. But since I invested so much time in it back then, I get a surprising amount of email about the things people find there. The fairly famous David Regal wrote me Thursday, RE, the controversy currently surrounding Dushek's half shell. I think this guy thinks I'm a fellow magician, because throughout this, he keeps making very inside references to the magic world. Tab and I were fairly good friends in the late 70s. And we remained so as we were both popular in the Columbus Magic Inner Circle. We all know about that inner circle, right? Until a series of pranks he and my friend Bill Kretsch played on one another escalated. I was probably 19 at the time. Tab would have been 17 or 18, and Kretsch the same. He and Bill had been doing things, you know, putting a skunk in the other's rabbit production box backstage, replacing loads in a square circle with dirty laundry, etc. All the classic pranks, right? This went on for several months. Finally, at the 1979 Magi Fest, Tab purchased a really expensive Votania from the late legendary Horace Marshall. The three of us were sharing a room at the Nell House in downtown Columbus, where the convention was being held. Kretsch decided to hide the flowers, not telling me that he'd done so. Later on, that night at the convention, at 10 p.m., I got on an elevator, loaded down with bags and the magic I bought. Tab was convinced I had stolen his Botania. He got on the elevator disguised in an odd overcoat, weird old man's hat, sunglasses, big umbrella, etc. But I love this disguise. Umbrella? Like, that's part of your disguise? What is he, like Mr. Magoo? So then he describes, over several pages, how Tab beat him up with the umbrella, trying to get his Botania back from him, when it was really Bill Kretsch playing another prank on him. He had put the Botania in Tab's trunk. So this guy said, after he had been beaten up for him, he called the cops. That was pretty much the end of Tab on the Columbus magic scene. He was blackballed from IBM and the Kirkendall Magic Hobby Club without a second thought, naturally. Eventually, in 1983, he died of an overdose. Cocaine, almost certainly. Although his parents refused to acknowledge anything of the sort. His mother, especially both his parents, from day one, were very wealthy, having spent literally tens of thousands on his act. Only the best equipment, Owen Brothers Illusions, virtually all of Marshall's very expensive Botania, etc. So they were real enablers.
Sometimes you'll see a storyteller who is really on book, and it really works, you know? Like, they'll be up there, they'll have it memorized, and they have a good story, so it really works. But yeah. I think more often than not, when you're on book like that, you get stuck in your story. And that's not the way we tell stories. When you're out at a bar, or when you're with your family, or wherever you're telling a story, it unfolds, and you kind of take these little tributaries. You kind of fall off the main story, because you get fascinated by something, and you say, what was I talking about? Okay, back to the real story, you know?
Yeah.
And it's what makes stories fun to me, is these... What do you call this? What do you call when the river goes off to the... It's a tributary,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I like going off on these tangents, these tributaries, and then kind of finding my way back to the story. And if you can do that in a fun way, it kind of simulates the experience of just hanging out with your friends and telling a story, because that's the way you do it, you know?
Absolutely.
You're not memorized. You don't memorize the story and say, oh, I can't wait to tell my friend this story. You just start, you know, it comes out. And oftentimes the first time you tell it, when you and your buddies are laughing in the bar or wherever you are, that's the best version of that story ever. So it's like when you bring it back up on stage, you want to kind of get that spontaneous feel, but you want to hit the meat of the story too.
Yeah, yeah. For me, it's always been because I spent so many years just doing character monologues that were super, super memorized.
Yes.
Like down to the uhs and thes, and you know. Somewhere along the line, I think I had a brain fart at a Risk show and had to stop and just ask the audience, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
What was I just talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was kind of stunned to be like, well, that's totally okay in this setting.
Yeah. And they might not even be like, they might not even be right. You'll say, where was I? And they'll say, oh, you're talking about the sewer grate. But really, you were talking about the sewer grate 5 minutes ago, but they want to talk about the sewer grate. Like, that's what the last thing that they, that where they were paying attention. So you go back to the sewer grate, you know?
So that's it. Tab Halley died of a cocaine overdose. Wait a minute. Epilogue number one. I was recently at a barbershop convention, all right? My old quartet got packed together, and Jim was there, Jim the Christian. First of all, don't think I'm making fun of these Christians. These guys are on fire. Their church, these guys go around the country saving women from human slavery. They go around the world. They fly to different countries and save people. Anyway, Jim and Brad were there. They were still working with this church. Now, Brad I found out from him after drinking a couple of beers. We used to listen to Brad. They would be doing their Bible study, and then we would hear creaking. We would hear his bed creaking, and then we would hear doors opening and closing. And we would say, "Oh, I wonder if those. I wonder if Brad is walking outside to masturbate because it's not something he can do in the room with his Christian witness, you know." And we would make little jokes about that, but we didn't think really that that was happening. It turns out that Brad was creaking in his bed, and he was sneaking out and going through the door every night to have sex with Judy, the magician's assistant. Brad was boffing Judy. Now, do you respect these Christian guys? They save women from human slavery, and they have sex with magician's assistants. These Christians have it together, believe me. Okay, epilogue number 2. Did you hear what I read? It said, eventually, Tab died of a drug overdose, most likely cocaine, in 1983. I sang with Tab Helly in 1989 at Canobie Lake Park. 1989. 6 years after he supposedly did a cocaine overdose and left the Columbus Magic Circle. Did Tab Helly pull off the biggest disappearing act of life? Don't believe your eyes. Don't believe your ears. Believe your heart. Thank you.
That was certainly different, don't you think? I'd love to know what you think if you write to us at Risk Show on either Twitter or Facebook. That's where you can reach us, and we always love to know what you think of what we're doing. Don't forget to check back next Thursday for a regular episode of Risk. Remember that Friday, July 8th, we have a fabulous live show at UCBLA, and on Tuesday, July 12th, our storytelling school, the Story Studio, starts up another 9-week storytelling workshop taught by me here in New York City. So go to thestorystudio.org. You might have noticed we only had one microphone to use in that recording with Mr. Shalhoub. That's because we only own one. If you would like to help us purchase another, you can go to the Support Us page at www.risk-show.com. This is Mark Vidler of Go Home Productions behind me now. Today's the day, folks. Take a risk.